Eat Drink Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. We have got a fun food-focused show for you today here on Eat Drink Indie Radio, an episode that's all about cooking. First, we'll talk with entrepreneur Stephanie Drury of Sprouts Cooking School in Carmel about how she teaches kids to cook and how she started it all from a spare bedroom. Then I want to talk recipes, family recipes, and I want to relaunch a segment I'm calling the Recipe Box Project. The idea is to cook and talk and sample a family recipe. And to start out, we've got local chef and culinary instructor Tom England of Ivy Tech Community College cooking up a favorite chicken and noodles dish that his mom always made. Then, since we're talking cooking, I just had to revisit one of my favorite interviews about retro recipes. We'll talk with local cooking enthusiast Lynn Steinhauer-Habig about Jell-O salads, ladies who lunched, and how tastes and cooking styles have changed over the years. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Sometimes a big idea starts really small enough to fit into a spare bedroom. That's how it began for entrepreneur Stephanie Drury of Sprouts Cooking School in Carmel. While home with her three kids, she had an idea for a food-focused summer camp. So she started in her spare bedroom, putting together her passion for cooking and her elementary education degree to teach kids as young as three how to cook. Then what started as a summer camp grew into something more. The classes continued into the fall and eventually outgrew her spare bedroom. Now Sprouts Cooking School has its own facility and has expanded to offer classes for older kids and even adults. We talked with Stephanie about how it all began and how she goes about teaching even the littlest kids to cook. When did you launch the business and why a cooking school for kids?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started Sprouts in 2015, and it was really inspired by my three children. I had always been cooking with them in my kitchen at home, and I wanted them to take cooking lessons. And so I had searched the internet. I could not find anything here locally. And it was about that time in my life, I think a lot of mothers go through that, where they're looking for something else.
What's next?
Yeah, as your children grow. And I was in that stage. I had my degree in elementary education, and I thought my real passion is cooking, but also working with kids. Like, could I blend the two together? And there wasn't really anything like a company like mine at the time, but I just thought maybe if I went for it, something good could come of that. So I started with little cooking camps in a spare bedroom in my home.
Oh my goodness. This
room into like a cooking studio.
Oh, that's great. Right in your house.
Yeah. I put like a single ad on Facebook. I think I could hold like 60 kids at the time. And within like a week or two, we were sold out for the summer.
Oh my goodness.
People were like messaging me saying that I can't get in. Do you have an in to get into the school? And I was like, well, maybe there is something there. And it's not just going to be for my friends.
So clearly a pent-up demand for this.
Yeah, I think that a lot of kids were probably watching it on Food Network.
Oh, absolutely.
And Chopped Junior. I think that that plays a large part in maybe their interest. And that's kind of how my kids were, too. They were like bombing the kitchen, not knowing like, you know, some basic, you know, I guess recipes or skills that they would need. But I guess that's part of it. And along with that, maybe they grew up with a mom or grandma that they had cooked with and just wanted to expand upon that knowledge. So this whole company kind of like was within my head and
I had some challenges
with that.
How did it grow then from the spare bedroom summer camp? Mm-hmm.
So let's see, in about a year after we had started, I couldn't keep up with demand in the house. And so I didn't want there to be frustration from our customers.
Right.
That they, like, anytime I released something, it would instantly sell out. And so I started teaching at the Monon Center in Carmel.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was teaching there two classes a week. And I was also teaching out of my home several nights a week.
Oh, my goodness.
And then also teenagers wanted to start cooking, too. So then I was actually teaching them in my kitchen, the little kids in the spare bedroom, birthday parties on the weekends. And it just became so much on our family. So
I'm imagining all the kids trooping in and out and all the chopping and,
oh my goodness,
and all the supplies, you know?
I know. So we never had a publicly listed address. You actually had to pay before you even would be emailed with the address.
Oh my goodness. Well, you know, you can't be too careful.
Well, right? Yeah. And I have three kids. And so, but you would come in like through my garage. I had a public restroom. People would like line the streets like 45 minutes before. My neighbors never once complained. I was like,
well, that's
shocked about that.
That's,
I didn't
awesome
even think
for
they
the
knew
neighbors.
What I was doing.
Oh no.
No. So, but in December of last year, we knew it was time. We were either going to have to grow or there was just no way to really stay the way we were anymore.
Right.
And so we signed a lease and opened a storefront.
Oh my goodness. So when did all that happen? When did you start looking for space?
I started exactly a year ago.
Oh my gosh.
October of last year. And the first few times I looked, I panicked and left it away.
Oh.
And then
what was daunting about it?
I think I was scared of putting my family in a financial situation that I didn't know, like,
oh,
in my house, you know, you can, if you didn't sell the classes,
well,
what
right.
do I lose?
Right, you still.
But if this doesn't work, like, my family and I financed this business.
Right.
I mean, I didn't ever want to take anything away from my husband and my children.
Right, and so there was a risk involved.
It's huge risk. And I already, my job was already a lot then, but I knew how much it would take from them, too. And so, you know, it's not just financially, but I was a full-time mom before I started this, and now I'm very much a full-time working mother.
Oh, you absolutely are.
So it was just a lot of conversations that I had to have with my husband and my children before we were really ready to do that.
Well, now, what's your background? You mentioned teaching.
Mm-hmm. So I have my degree in elementary education, but I was home with my kids. And so I just have a love of cooking. I think that part of the reason Sprouts is successful is you have to wear your teacher hat a lot, and sometimes more than cooking.
more of the teaching.
Yes.
Right.
Our staff is teachers who also love to cook. We do have a chef on staff, too. But you really have to be able to manage that many children.
Now, how many kids are in the classes?
16.
That's like an elementary school classroom.
Yeah. We did have a private party this past week that was, I think, 22 kids.
Oh,
so,
my goodness.
You know, we can do, like, various sizes, but I think 16 is best.
Now, walk me through how a class is. How do you handle all those kids, mm-hmm. and keeping them focused? Because I'm sure staying on task is a challenge.
Yes. So we, in our new space, we're able to divide them by age groups. So we have 3 through 5, 6 through 8. In 9 through 13. In our old space, all the kids were together.
Oh, my goodness.
So now we have a fabulous teacher who is a preschool teacher, and she does our 3 through 5s and 6 through 8. She reads them stories if they need, like, a little brain break, because the 3 through 5-year-olds can only do it for so long.
Oh, my goodness.
So we cook, and then we read a little story that goes along with what we're talking about that day. Our 6 to 8-year-olds, they're somewhere in the middle. So, you know, maybe we eat outside on our patio, and then that breaks it up. And our 9 through 13-year-olds, they're on heat. They use real knives. And so they're really able to immerse themselves in that cooking experience, and they're fine. They could do it for a very long time.
But now tell me what a class for the 3 to 5-year-olds are like. What are they actually doing?
So let's see. Last week they had a semester class, and they made alphabet soup.
Okay.
And they made little pumpkin patch, like they were. So you would use a cookie cutter and cut some puff pastry to look like a pumpkin. And then we filled it with cheese, and then they cut little peppers to look like the eyes and the smile. And then we baked that. So really at that age, we're introducing them to new foods mm-hmm. that they may not have had before, or foods that they think they've tried and that they don't like.
Right, and they can have very strong opinions at that age.
Yes, we call yogurt cream because they have very strong feelings about yogurt. I don't know.
Well, that's interesting.
I know. So, but it's really just like building upon those flavors so that they'll be more. I think that when they're cooking, they're excited about doing it. They're more inclined to try all of the other kids. We have a saying like, don't yuck my yum.
Oh, I love that saying. I say that with my kids.
So we try like really hard that they have to at least try one bite. We do have it's called a no thank you bite, but at least you have to try one bite. And the next time they're more inclined to try more. So I don't know. It's fun to see with that age group.
Well, now, talk a little bit about why it's important, the life skills that you're teaching, mm-hmm. and sort of, you know, building that culture of cooking so that it's part of their lives.
Well, I think, as you said, life skill, that's a word I use all the time. Cooking's a life skill you need to know. For me, I think it's important that kids learn it when they're really young so they can kind of develop that passion and that romance for cooking. Because if they are passionate about it and they want to do it when they're little, I think we can build upon that as they grow and they're older. I also think they're more inclined to eat what they make and try new foods. So I just think that they're more inclined to try the healthier foods that you want your child to eat if they're involved in that process.
So it's kind of a win-win-win then.
Yeah. I mean, I would hope.
We've been talking with Stephanie Drury of Sprouts Cooking School. We'll be right back with more from Stephanie about building her business here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Jolene Ketzenberger, and we are back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio talking with Stephanie Drury of Sprouts Cooking School in Carmel. The school has grown over the past couple of years and now has its own location. Stephanie tells us about growing the business from a spare bedroom, the challenges of being an entrepreneur, and what she's learned along the way. Let's talk a little bit now about the growth of the business.
Mm-hmm.
So did you see it having a lot of success when you first started? Did you have a business plan, you know, with 5 years, 10 years down the road, that sort of thing?
No, I didn't. I was just at home with my kids and just thought that this would be something for the summer. I didn't even know if I was going to continue it past the summer of 2015.
So this started, Sprouts Cooking School started mm-hmm. as a summer project?
Yeah, I didn't want to be constantly peddling it to my friends. And I thought, I can peddle it to them for 3 months and make them all sign up. But after that, if this is embarrassing or I fail, no one will know. So there wasn't a grand plan. I mean, I made a logo. I had a graphic designer help with that. And we were an LLC. You know, we had like some proper processes in place. But as far as to where it has grown now, I never thought that. But I will say, like, now that I look back, I think I just, like, really kept my head down mm-hmm. and wanted it so badly that it was just a lot of little steps over a longer period of time. And I just kept going for it.
Well, now, how did it start? You mentioned mm-hmm. earlier that it was a summer program.
Yep.
And then how did you decide to grow it from there?
So after that summer, I sat down with my husband and I said, I think maybe I could keep going. And he's like, I hope you keep going. We spent money on this room, so keep going.
Right. So you redid the spare bedroom, right?
Yeah. I mean, he painted it. We bought some tables. I didn't have a computer, so I bought a computer. So, you know, just some like basic little things. But we then decided that I was going to do like semester style classes, and I didn't know how it was going to work when children went back to school.
Oh, sure, right. So it had been a summer thing. So
it was summer and kids were out of school. I was like, is my success based upon the fact that kids just aren't in school? Like, what will it be like? And so I thought, you know, I'm going to do semester classes just like you would do basketball.
Oh, sure.
I'm going to do
extracurricular
cooking lessons.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so I started it like that. And it was successful, but I made it too long.
What do you
I
mean?
Made
like,
8 weeks.
Oh, 8 weeks is a long time.
It's too long.
That's
and
true.
So I learned that. I had a lot of growing, like getting to know my customer and like what they want. They want 3 to 4 weeks at a time.
Oh, okay.
And so,
they'll commit to that, right?
Yeah. So our classes, our semester classes, are 3 to 4 weeks. They're basically the whole month. It just depends on how the weeks and the month fall.
Do they meet once a week?
They meet once a week. And they're an hour and a half long because you can't have the kids out too late. So they start at 5:30 because working parents,
sure,
too difficult. Even 5:30 is hard for a lot of working parents.
Right.
But we end at 7 because we don't want the kids home too late.
Right. So you're not taking up the whole evening.
Correct.
With
And we have a lot of families that travel from fairly far away. So I try to be cognizant of that, too. Like last winter, so in March, when I finally wrapped up in my house, I had a family driving from Muncie every night. So,
oh my goodness.
Yeah, I don't know how they find us here, but they do. And so I try to just always remember that it's not just people locally here, but we have quite a reach.
Oh my goodness. Now, how did you get to that? You know, how did it grow from the spare bedroom, mm-hmm, and then you said you looked for a spot. So take me from the spare bedroom to your own facility.
I think part of the reason that we've grown is there's been an organic sharing of our business. So we had quite a lot of followers and other moms that were interested.
Mm-hmm.
That led it to be, we were sold out very quickly. And then when I was at the Monon, loved it, wonderful people, carrying all that stuff.
Oh, hauling the things around. I didn't think about that.
Well, it was just me, and there's no cooking equipment. And so I was, lugging a microwave. That's all I had was a microwave.
Oh, my
And I
goodness.
Had a hot plate. And hot plates are the worst. They, go out every 5 seconds. So I always had two spare ones. I'd be like, well, we blew that one. So on to the next.
Oh, my
And
God.
Then, lugging the cooler and all that and through the snow half the time. And I think I was just burnt out trying to make – I was so afraid, but I was so burnt out trying to make the other situation work.
Right.
I knew eventually I was going to have to bite the bullet.
And get your own space.
Yeah. I mean, I really knew that if I wanted to take it to the next level, I had to – I was either going to lose people because they were frustrated.
Right.
Or I could stop being scared and go for it.
Oh, so what was it like to take that leap and find the space and say, okay, this space could work?
Yeah, I love our space so much. It was perfect. It's not one of the ones that we found by my realtor, actually, even though he was a huge help. I live right by where our space is.
Nice.
And then I found out Cafe Potashoe was going in there, and I knew that we shared similar clientele.
Mm-hmm.
And Pizzology is on the other end.
That's
cap.
Right.
So I thought the same people that were coming to my business would be going there, and they would find me. But most importantly for me, it had an outdoor space, which
right.
I really need for my summer camps because our kids are there for 3 hours a day, and we do go outside and take breaks outside, and we have a garden. I really wanted the kids to learn to garden.
Nice. Uh-huh.
And learn about local food and how we can incorporate that into our cooking. And
So did you just recognize it and say, the space is going to
work? Oh, yeah. The minute I saw it, I was between Matt and one other, and it was just perfect. And I'm kind of the kind of person when I see something I like, I can't get my mind off of that and I won't let it go.
Right.
So I'll fixate on it. And I found it and I loved it. And yeah, never looked back on that one.
Well, what have been some of the challenges of the whole business, the starting the business and growing the business? Anything that has been sort of challenging along the way?
I think that any business owner would say that there's a lot of challenges. For me, one of them is that I'm just one person, and we've grown pretty quickly. I don't have any business partners.
It's just you answering the emails and taking the reservations.
Still comes from me. The phone calls are really still returned by me. So it's every birthday party is booked by me, which we sell a ton of birthday parties.
Oh,
so
I
there's
bet.
So
yeah.
much of the business that still lives in my head. And it's me. We have fantastic employees, and I'm so grateful for that. But if I could clone two or three of me so that all the hours could get done, I think just, when you first start a business, it's just the sheer hours.
Right.
And the intensity involved in keeping that machine going. I already thought is working pretty hard before, but this is just very,
very hard.
We've been talking with Stephanie Drury of Sprouts Cooking School. Check out SproutsCookingSchool.com or look for it on Facebook and Instagram. At the heart of what we talk about each week here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio is food. Where it comes from, how we get it, how we prepare it, and how we serve it. It's all tied together, and it definitely brings us together around the table. And memories made around the table stay with us. And that's what I want to talk about in an Eat, Drink, Indie Radio segment called The Recipe Box Project. I want to talk with people about their family recipes, about favorite dishes, who made them, and how it was done. I want to hear the stories of food and explore how food brings us together around the table and how we keep those recipes alive. So we're relaunching our Recipe Box Project, which we started this past winter with Chef Tom England of Ivy Tech Community College. We're going to be talking with more local cooks about their favorite family recipes, but Tom gets us started with a dish his mom made called Popeye.
So this is a family recipe that my mom made, and actually her grandmother made, so it's been at least four generations it's been passed down.
Oh my goodness, I love that.
It's called Popeye, and I always knew it as Popeye. And I just thought my mom made up this name.
Well, it seems like something a mom would make up,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. But in classes a couple of years ago, I was talking about it, and one of the students said, oh, no, we make Popeye. And so we started looking this up, and there's all kinds of recipes that are very similar to this called Popeye.
But what is it, though?
So it's chicken and noodles, basically. But,
oh, my gosh.
The noodles special cut, and no matter who calls it Popeye, the noodles are always cut in the square shape.
Okay.
And they're thicker than normal.
All right.
But the stocks are sometimes a little bit different. And it looks like it comes from a German background, German heritage.
Yeah, okay, I can see that.
So here in Indiana, I mean, there's definitely enough of people around to do that, to bring that heritage to it.
So how does it start?
So I'm going to start making a little stock here.
Uh-huh.
In the absence of a peeler, I'm peeling my potato
okay.
with a knife here. My mom, of course, would do this in her hand.
Oh, right, with the little paring knife, right?
It always scares me to death.
I know, my mom always used a paring knife, and one time she was peeling potatoes at my house, and I handed her a potato peeler. She said, can I just have a little knife?
Yeah, exactly. That's my mom, who actually has been a professional chef all of my life, but she still peels
goodness.
Those potatoes with
that's great.
A knife in her hand. Yeah.
So you're going to start with a stock, right?
Yeah, but you know, this is a recipe that middle class families would do, or
right.
you know, they have to make that meal stretch.
Right. Right. Oh, exactly. So
yeah.
this is a regular family recipe.
Absolutely. So the thickener here is potatoes.
Okay.
And so as she made the stock, she would chop up potatoes in here.
Right.
And in the stock, you know, the potatoes would actually boil,
right?
Which gives it this great, like, mealy type of texture in it as well.
Right. So she's not, you know, making a roux and thickening
right.
it with flour or cornstarch or anything.
Yeah, and you know, there's noodles going in there too.
Well, no, that's
and we'll
right.
talk more about that. But
okay.
there's some flour in there as well.
Really?
So
okay.
She put the potatoes in there, onions,
uh-huh.
And then half stock, half water.
Okay, to cook the potatoes.
To cook everything, yeah. So we're going
right.
to also put in here pork and chicken.
So you're going to end up with a really killer stock.
Exactly, yeah. We're making this broth. It's really intense.
Yeah.
That is going to, you know, carry the flavor of the noodles.
And it's going to smell great. I mean,
that's what I'm
anticipating is
yeah.
the smell of this.
We were talking, so we've got some already simmering in the background.
Right, I know.
Oh, yeah, it's making me hungry.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to put a half a chicken in here, too.
Okay.
Half a chicken, because you can use the other half a chicken for another meal later in the week.
Of course,
right?
Because you know, this is family cooking.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And then about a half a pound of pork.
Okay.
And I'm just going to slice this up into, you know, slices that when it's cooked, it's just going to fall apart.
Oh, it will. Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to put all that in there.
Oh, my gosh.
And then just let that simmer.
Uh-huh.
And so this would be simmering at the house all day. So, you know, it would be 6 hours of just this smell in the house.
Exactly.
The first cold day of the year is when she would do it first, right?
See, that's beautiful right now because, you know.
All the doors are closed, yeah. I could still now see the moisture on the windows.
Steamed up. Yeah, steamed up kitchen windows.
Yeah,
how cool is that?
Yeah.
Well, all right. So,
that's simmering.
Next? Okay.
She would make the noodles. So.
Okay, so you're going to make these noodles from scratch, exactly, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, I think that's something that maybe could intimidate people, you know, making noodles from scratch.
There's only two ingredients in noodles.
I think it sounds more complicated than it really is.
It does. It does sound more complicated for sure. So we're just going to take the flour and eggs.
Okay.
I was talking to my mom last night as I was preparing for this.
Oh, see, that's great.
And, you know, she's so excited that we're doing this. And then she tells me a few things that she's never told me before. So she's giving me this recipe
so many times.
So you
got some secrets about this recipe.
Yes.
Okay.
You know, like all good, I think, family recipes, there's always one or two things that aren't written down.
Yeah, and I never know if that's on purpose.
Yes.
Because that way, if I give you my recipe, here's most of the recipe, but maybe secret ingredient there.
Well, her secret ingredient is she always put poultry seasoning in with the flour when she made the noodles.
So the noodles are seasoned.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that was the thing she told me last night is like, by the way, there was always poultry seasoning.
I love that.
You know? There were some things that were a little bit different every time she made it, but it always had poultry seasoning.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
So,
they're tasting it and be like, oh, man, these noodles really absorbed a lot of that flavor.
Exactly.
You know? and it's poultry seasoning. That's fabulous.
I've eaten this recipe with a lot of chefs. So every time I go home, she has to make it. It's required. Yes, absolutely.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I'll bring back and she'll make a big batch and I'll bring back leftovers. And lots of chefs have tried this and we were like, trying to detail like all the stuff that's in there to try to duplicate it. I've never been able to exactly duplicate it. And
now,
I don't know if it's because, you know, you're not running in and out of the house and smelling that smell. And
well, that's right.
As she made these noodles too, she would put newspaper down on the table, right?
Okay.
And then spread these noodles out on them for them to dry. I don't know why, but...
To dry the noodles? Absorb
moisture? Maybe.
I don't know, keep down the mess.
To keep the wood from the table from getting bad? Right? I don't know.
So what do you got in here?
We've got flour in here. So I've got 2 cups of flour.
Okay.
The poultry seasoning.
Poultry seasoning.
A little bit of garlic seasoning, too, actually.
Okay.
I love garlic. So,
right?
And then I'm breaking eggs into here. So the amount of eggs depends on how much humidity there is. So the flour is going to absorb more or less... based on how much it already has in it. So it's just kind of a feel thing. It shouldn't be sticky at all when it's all mixed.
Right.
And I'm just doing this all by hand. It's kind of going to get mealy. It'll look like, I don't know, little marbles after a minute or two here. And that's the kind of look we're looking for. I'm not really, like, digging at it.
So this is you're not squeezing it together.
No, not
right
at this
now.
Point. Right.
Right.
I'm just trying to moisten everything up here.
Now, you know, people might think that it looks like it's not going to come together.
Correct. Yeah. So if you see that now, that's the kind of moisture that I'm looking for.
Okay.
And this is when I'm going to start putting it all together.
All right.
May need just a little bit more.
But see, it's by feel, right?
It is absolutely by feel. If it's tacky, you know you need to add more. If it's not coming together, you know you need to... if it's not sticking together, you need to add more.
If it's too sticky,
you need to add flour.
Right.
So I'm going to add a white here.
Okay.
And save that yolk to see if we need more.
Now, this is one of those things that, as you make it, you know what it's supposed to feel like.
Right.
You know, and I think that's what...
It
scares people because that's what your mom or you know whoever was cooking in a family... It's what they did. They did it often enough so they could tell what it felt like, you know?
It's coming together now. So you can see I'm squeezing this.
All right.
It's all stuck together.
It's starting to look like what you might think of a noodle batter.
Yeah.
This is
exactly the same noodle batter that I would make at any pasta.
Okay, right.
Can you hand me the flour?
Absolutely.
Did I already grab it? Yep, perfect.
Here we go.
So I'm going to flour the tabletop, and I'm just going to roll it here on the tabletop.
Okay. I love the rolling pin. Now, that's a serious rolling pin.
So I went to Italy and studied pasta making.
Oh, how cool is that?
First day I'm there. So we start out, it's called the Italian Culinary Institute for Foreigners.
Uh-huh.
And we start out in this castle that was built in 1492.
So you're making pasta in a castle,
one
thing.
Yeah.
which is very cool.
With a chef, and the chef throws this pasta together real quick, and I've been in the industry, I mean, this was 8 years ago, so I've been in it, you know, 20, 30 years at this point.
Right.
And so I ask, you know, is this your standard pasta dough recipe? And he looks at me like, what do you mean? He says, no, we make pasta different every time we make it a different sauce.
Really?
And so that started making me realize, okay, you know, this is just a blank canvas for you to create what your sauce is going to be.
So you can add that. So right. Mm-hmm. So you can add those things and make it different.
I'm going to take that yolk back.
Okay.
The whole idea of adding that garlic powder and the poultry seasoning would be typical. Uh-huh. I mean, it's something to add a little bit more flavor to it.
Exactly.
But yeah, he said, you know, sometimes I use all egg yolks. Sometimes I use whites. Sometimes I add chicken stock to it instead of water to it. And, you know, it's that whole idea of this is just something you can play with. You can do different things. So to be scared of it is something that shouldn't happen because you can play. This is just something to play with.
Because it isn't a complicated thing, right?
Correct, yeah. I like the three wise men, right? If you go in there and take kids, they ask you if they want to bring out some pizza dough for the kids to play with.
Sure.
You know, it's the same thing. I mean, start playing with your dough and you know, seeing what you could do with it.
Well, and by doing that, you get comfortable with how it feels.
Exactly, exactly.
So kind of a muscle memory thing.
Yeah. On that trip also, went into Tuscany and was studying at another castle. It was built in 7 AD.
This is a great trip.
It's a fabulous trip. And so we've been, you know, talking with all these Italians and their history and stuff, and this little old lady comes out, is going to start the class. And she is like that big, but her forearms are that big.
Oh my goodness. She's been doing that. Yeah. She's been pressing dough out like that.
Yeah. But it was a 70-year-old Scottish lady who taught us to make pasta in Tuscany.
That's
she'd
awesome.
She lived there for so long, and yeah, it was great. All right. So this is kind of worked together.
Right.
The other thing is she would always roll it right away.
Okay.
And, you know, when I make pasta, I let it rest for about an hour so the ingredients come back together. But if you roll it right away, the dough gets a little bit tougher, and
okay,
so the noodle will have more of a bite in the end.
Oh, sure. So, now, see, it is going to be a little harder to roll out right away.
Yeah, it's going to
come back every time you push it out.
Yep, absolutely. But I'm going to roll this down to about a quarter of an inch thick, which is really thick for dough.
Yeah.
Usually with a noodle dough, I'm going, you know, an eighth
really,
inch.
Really thin.
Yeah, so I can read through it. In this case, I definitely do not want to read through it.
Because this is going to be a hearty, really a hearty noodle. I mean,
it's a meal. Yeah.
It is.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so this isn't going to be a what you'd think of as a pasta, you know?
Right, yeah. You know? No, you know, we definitely would think of it as Popeye. It was totally different from the
See, pasta. I love that Popeye. I want to know where that word comes from, where the name of the recipe comes from.
You know, doing a little bit of research, they were a lot of conjecture that it came from pot pie.
Oh, okay.
So with the New England tradition of pot pies.
Okay, I could kind of see that.
And using the same dough that they would have done.
This is a pot pie sort of hearty filling.
It would be the same filling, really, for a lot of pot pies.
I could see that.
Yeah.
So the dough is spreading out now. You're getting it to kind of where you want it to be.
And then as it gets to the size that I want, or the thickness I want it, I'll cut it into 1-inch squares.
Okay.
Rugged. And pizza cutter works fine.
Uh-huh.
If you have a pizza cutter. But,
okay,
you know, she was never very specific about, you know,
so
making
this
them exactly
is this
square.
Is a this is a rustic recipe. This isn't
Absolutely.
You don't have to be exacting, right?
Right. So once these
Oh, that's
cut,
beautiful. Right.
They were on paper, newspapers.
Your newspapers, right?
And covered with flour. I mean, covered. It looked like a little snow scene at times.
Oh, that's great.
And, you know, we were talking about thickening the soup.
Right.
That was part of the thickener. And I never really
realized.
Obviously, it helps it from sticking together at this point. But when she put them in, she never really dumped all that extra flour off.
Oh, she just picked them up and popped
them
in.
Throw them in the boiling water.
All right.
And that's really where we ended up with our additional thickening power to it.
So, you know, food can really, really does a lot for that welcoming kind of feeling. And I think that's what we all want from a recipe. And when we're cooking for friends or family, you know, you want them to feel welcome and loved,
yeah,
you know?
This is love.
It is,
this
right?
This is love, yeah. That's that definition of comfort food, right? Yeah. It's stuff that makes you feel like you're loved and hugged, right?
We've been talking and cooking with Chef Tom England of Ivy Tech Community College. Stay with us for more here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org.
To a pretty extensive collection of cookbooks. Classics like Julia Child and The Joy of Cooking, big collections from Bon Appetit or Gourmet, authoritative how-tos from Cooks Illustrated, celebrity cookbooks and single ingredient cookbooks and books that focus on a specific technique. But I've got a particular shelf dedicated to the community cookbook, or what I tend to call church lady cookbooks. Although many of them are from organizations like Tri Kappa or the Junior League. And I especially like the community cookbooks because they seem to truly reflect what people around the country in the 1950s or 60s or 70s were really cooking in a particular time and place. Want to know what people really ate in various parts of the country? Check the church cookbooks and the Service Club Ladies Auxiliary cookbooks and even the recipe pamphlets put out by the local gas company or appliance dealer. In fact, it was in the recipe book that came with her vintage Osterizer blender that one of our guests this week found the instructions for the Jell-O salad that she made for me to try earlier this week. Indianapolis resident Lynn Steinauer-Habig pulled out a few 70s-era cookbooks, including the Osterizer cookbook with the Salad of Gold recipe, and I stopped by to take a look and to actually try a Jell-O salad. So you just mix it all up?
Well, the Osterizer, it came in the Osterizer cookbook, so you use for everything.
So you still have cookbook?
I still have the cookbook.
Cookery, it says.
It almost fell out at the... There it is. And the lime cheese, which I think you said someone else is making, that was a popular one. And this, and then the other one, and this even goes back farther than the 70s, but the was one that was cherry Jell-O, red hots, cream cheese that had been rolled into little balls with chopped pecans, probably celery. I imagine celery was in there somewhere. But you just, no matter where you went for luncheon or bridge, they were going to pop up.
It's beautiful in a very odd way.
Oh, it is odd.
You think?
Well, it's odd because we don't do this anymore. Now salads are, hand-torn and have 17 different kinds of lettuces that are good for you and kale and who knows what else.
Oh, my goodness. So we actually get to try a Jell-O salad. So tell me about the Jell-O salad, though. What's in it?
Well, it doesn't sound very appealing I started to say 1915. This was 2015. It's carrots, cottage cheese, gelatin, the Jell-O brand, gelatin, lemon gelatin, crushed pineapple, pineapple juice, and the creaminess of it is evaporated milk.
Well, okay.
So it's not bad for you.
I'm going to give it a try.
But the proof is in the taste, so have a bite. Oh, it's not so bad.
No, it isn't. How interesting is that?
Ooh.
It's tart.
I believe it has vinegar in it. That's the one. Well, see, 70 years old. I forgot the vinegar.
Vinegar in it. So it's light and tart, and it has a smoothish texture.
Fluffy.
Yeah. Fluffy, that's what it is.
Now, I was thinking it was back in the day, it was fun to have, ladies who lunch, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me that it might be fun to use these little Pyrex molds. And do individual ones. In fact, you could do
individual
different colors
Jell-O molds,
or, whatever.
Yeah.
And then you could have your mint leaves or whatever, or your butter lettuce already out. It really
right,
looks,
some lettuce.
It doesn't look very pretty, pale yellow and pale white.
No, I don't. I think it's just lovely. I think it's oddly lovely.
Well, it is. It is kind of oddly lovely, but the color is something because it's sort of a, what would you call that? A pale. Pale, pale yellow, with a little blush of peach or something. I mean, it's a kind of a challenging color all by itself. You want to make something a little more festive.
when did they disappear? When did we stop making Jell-O molds and Jell-O salads? Or maybe we still make them?
Well, most of what I've been talking to you about, these molds were centered around ladies who lunched, ladies who played bridge, ladies who were ladies of leisure. And those ladies of leisure went to work. That's exactly right. So everyone's working now. I mean, work outside the home. So that kind of fun meal, light meal that would accompany whatever the social event was, kind of began to disappear. And then we got a little more cognizant of health.
True, true. So in the 70s, when so many women went back to work, so there went your bridge club.
There went your bridge club. Your book group may have survived. It would be in the evening, but that usually brought out wine. I mean, you don't need a Jell-O mold after 5 o'clock.
That's exactly right.
Just between you and me and the mud fence.
It's tasty.
It is tasty. Well, I have to tell you, when I made it up, and my daughter was teasing me about having made this mold that she hasn't had since she was probably in the 4th grade, she said, you know, if there's any left over, we'd probably like it for dinner. She being the working woman. So I'll probably take it up there.
Well, I think it, you know, because it's interesting and different, and it, you know, it's kind of refreshing, actually.
Well, it is. Anything cold, right, you know, is refreshing and light.
Honestly, I know it has carrots in there, but it doesn't seem like a salad.
Oh, no. No, it's much more like a dessert. And with a kind of a Jell-O salad like this, the hostess, and this was very popular back in that day, would have had some sort of a stacked sandwich. There would have been Boston brown bread and maybe chicken salad and then another piece of maybe a whole wheat bread, then maybe an egg salad or a Philadelphia cream cheese pineapple mix, then another piece of bread, then a pineapple, then another piece of bread, and then it would be iced with cream cheese that had been softened with, you know, some sort of a milk product. So that would have been the main dish, and then you'd have had this. I mean, that's a lot of calories by the time.
That's a lot of calories.
There's a lot of calories. And bridge is an invigorating game, but it doesn't use much in the way of calories. But that's just the way we lived in those days. And it's kind of fun to have been thinking about the olden days.
We've been talking retro recipes and Jell-O salads with local cooking enthusiast Lynn Steinhauer-Habig. We'll be right back with more from Lynn here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Change. That's an inescapable fact, but sometimes it's fun to talk about just how much things have changed over the years, and that's certainly true of food. We've been talking about cooking this week here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, and so I just had to revisit a conversation with local cooking enthusiast Lynn Steinhauer-Habig about how times and habits and cooking styles have changed, from finger sandwiches and Jell-O salads for the Bridge Club to how we get dinner on the table today.
You say the olden days. It's not like a million years ago. We're probably talking the 70s?
But we've blinked since then. You know, we have really, as women, and in my family at least, women were the primary meal makers and meal planners and so forth. We just think so differently about food. My sister and I talk about this a lot. You know, this is not something. When she made green beans for dinner, they may have been cooking for 45 minutes. You know, we would never do that now. In fact, ours are practically raw when we, you know, our whole mindset is different about how we approach food, what food means. Look how hard it is to have your whole family together at table.
Oh, exactly, to have a dinner where everyone's there and that everyone is going to eat the same thing, you
sure.
know, because,
sure,
you know,
because
some people don't eat this.
This person is a vegetarian, right. This person is a vegan, right. Vegan, this, you know, whatever.
Right.
Our family's full of, you know, interesting food communities.
So we have, you know, somebody doesn't want this, somebody doesn't want that. So you end up sort of catch as catch can.
Mm-hmm. And sports.
Oh, my gosh, and our schedules, right?
Theater things, art, you know, all the myriad of activities that not only our kids are in, but we're in.
Well, absolutely. Now, you know, back in the day, did you typically, you were a sort of a back-to-nature kind of person. You were doing all the bread-making and cooking and everything, right?
Well, I still do just because I love it, you know. And if it's your passion, it doesn't matter
how
much it is. You do anything to do it. But it's always been important, and we had breakfast, lunch, and dinner as a family, period.
And you were cooking that.
And I was cooking it, sure. I was growing most of it.
Oh, my goodness.
But that's just what I like to do. I'm not saying, you know, I was not the pioneer woman, but I would have liked to have been, but I would like all my modern amenities.
I was thinking more along the lines of Earth Mother, you know, that sort of thing. Mother.
Well, I was a hippie.
See? I knew it.
Beads. And but it was, it's, we still try on Sundays to get together as a family. And, of course, your family grows because the children grow up and they get married and have children and the children have boyfriends and girlfriends. And, you know, it's wonderful to have these big things. And it's hard to get a Sunday when we're all together, but we do the best we can.
Yeah, tell me about some of the recipes. Obviously, these are ones you can always tell the page in a cookbook where you've actually used it because it has little spots and you've written something on it.
There are many of them. I got a kick out of one of your postings the other day about, and I can't remember what it was. It not truly vicious,
malicious and
malicious.
Delicious.
Yeah.
Right.
But I looked through all of the things. No, truly disturbing recipes.
Truly disturbing. Oh, the good housekeeping.
Yes.
It was like a.
Most of those I've made.
Oh my gosh!
Truly.
Oh, now have you made the bananas wrapped in ham?
No, that I didn't. But you know, again, it's a color thing. It looked ugly. But if you did something with the color of it, it probably would be good. We put salt on our brownies now. You know,
right.
That's salt
and
sweet.
And, you know, we wrap prosciutto around the melon.
Sure.
I know, so I guess it's not that much of a leap to wrap it around a banana, maybe.
No.
Well, maybe it is. and then to cover it with hollandaise, you know, there's that.
Oh, you could put hollandaise on anything and it's good. Okay. I could eat hollandaise just with a spoon. I could also be as big as a Sherman tank. why gild a lily? But there, the liverwurst pate with cream cheese on it, that was a staple on
was
Christmas
it really
buffet.
It was like iced, only you cut into it and it's and it's like liverwurst or Braunschweig or something.
And I'm again 70 years old, I've forgotten what some of them were, but my sister and I got such a kick out of looking through that. We ate this. Oh, this was so-and-so's popular recipe when we got together. And well, in fact, we used to have a lot of parties in between.
And did you entertain?
And Christmas. Oh, yes. Did a lot of.
Oh, now, this is a used cookbook. This one is a good one, you can tell.
When I first got, I have the original food processor, the original Cuisinart.
Do you really? An original
has
Cuisinart?
Broken it so badly, it's almost not usable. Well, I called the company and I said, is it possible to have a trade in? Because this is a little bitty bowl. The plastic is all breaking on the bowls. I can't get any replacement parts for it. And they said, well, no, they wouldn't give me a trade-in, but they'd love to have it for their museum.
Oh, my goodness, you have a museum piece.
I have a museum piece. But without, I mean, the Cuisinart is something that's one of the tools I simply could not live without.
Now, that seems to be a very 70s thing.
Oh, I guess. My KitchenAid standard mixer and the Cuisinart were the two. They may have been wedding presents, late 60s.
That sounds about right.
I still start using it. There it is.
Oh, my.
And it's called a snow-capped pâté. But anyway, that's something we'd have every single.
And it does look like it could fool you into thinking perhaps it was a cake, you know?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. Well, there was another recipe, a watermelon cake, that you made with, let's see. You made it in a big Pyrex plastic, and it was a Pyrex recipe from the Pyrex company. How did they do that? It was a green Jello, and then something, and then it ended up ice cream on the inside. Oh, it was curious. I'll have to look for that because that really is an odd one.
So Nessie, you've got notes on your chicken liver pate recipe, right?
Well, because chicken livers are not the same as Braunschweiger. I mean, it's a little different. My family liked the chicken liver best, but I have found most people, if they think, well, especially the friends of the children, they had no sophistication at all. But all of these wonderful casserole-y things, which were just such.
Even the colors in the pictures look kind of 70s, you know?
Yeah, well, now there's one of those kind of odd-looking little wrapped-up things with sauce over it. Chicken and tango.
Oh, Nessie, you're making quenelles there in the picture, you know? So that's a very
I never made those.
Very popular thing these days.
What was it? Something de neige. Boule de neige.
Snow.
And it was a custard that had little meringue-y things floating in
something
it.
In the snow, right?
For a Christmas buffet. We made it. Lots of things with saucies. Oh, I used to love things like Coquille Saint-Jacques. And I still have all the little seashells that...
Oh, really? Oh, my goodness. You did that because those are the things that, those retro recipes, it seems like things that I would like to try. And I, you know, because I've never made them.
Oh, it's delicious. And it's really easy to do. But again, highly caloric. I mean, hugely caloric. And people my age are worried about their cholesterol. I don't know about you. Of course, if you die with a smile on your face, there's nothing wrong with that.
It's the Coquille Saint-Jacques that did me in.
There are worse things in this life. But anyway, and quiche, of course.
Oh,
quiche
was
just 70s. Oh, my. People say, well, how do you learn to do this? Well, you just start doing it. And when you're learning, you don't know you don't know how to do it. You just follow. If you can read and follow directions. I say that about gardening, too. You know, if you know the recipe, you can grow anything.
Well, that's true. So you just follow
directions. But just get over the fear of I can't do it. And just try it. And if your Jell-O mold slides off the plate, well, too bad. Eat it off the kitchen counter with a spoon. Got to have a sense of humor.
Exactly. Oh, my goodness.
Got to have a sense of humor.
Now, you have a Joy of Cooking cookbook, too. But now,
this is
a classic. 19,
now, this I don't write in. But
now, was this your mother's, or did you get it?
It was my aunt's, who just passed away at 101 week and one day.
Oh my God!
Isn't that just phenomenal? And she was happy as a clam until the day she decided to go away.
We've been talking with Lynn Steinauer-Habig about vintage recipes, including a classic Jell-O salad. For more on the classic recipes that we've been talking about today, you can look for me, Jolene Ketzenberger, on Facebook and Instagram, and check out the photos. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, and Do Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for tuning in to talk cooking with us today, and thanks also to our guests, Stephanie Drury of Sprouts Cooking School, Chef Tom England of Ivy Tech Community College, and local cooking enthusiast Lynn Steinauer-Habig. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, and Do Radio. Eat, Drink, Indie Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat, drink, Indie.